Jeffries case, and that would be Mr. Freeman and Mr. Griffith and these are cross appeals, and these will be allocated pursuant to our rules, 20 minutes each, so you may divide your time accordingly. And Mr. Feynman, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yes, ma'am.
Mr. Feynman, do you desire to save some time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
And how much would you like, sir?
5 minutes.
Okay, very good. And counsel should also, these cases are complex, but just so you know, I'm sure you would expect, we have thoroughly reviewed all of the filings that you have presented and have researched your cases, both of your cases, and to see what we could find. So we are prepared, and you don't need to spend a lot of time bringing us up to date necessarily with the facts, but it is your 20 minutes, so you may use it accordingly.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I think I signed all these correct.
Okay, thank you, sir. If the parties are ready?
We are.
Sure.
You may proceed.
Okay, there were two appeals. I just don't know which one's first.
We have them docketed together. That's why we're giving you 20 minutes. So I have the record number 660173, which is Jeffries versus the Uninsured Employers Fund.
Yes, sir.
Docketed first, but you may deal with them all together if you so desire.
Okay, thank you very much. My name is Jimmy Feynman. I'm from Lewisburg, and I represent Mr. Jeffries in this matter. I appreciate you, the court having reviewed all the documents, and I'll try to go put my finger right on the error in this case. The Rodriguez administrator, the estate of Rodriguez versus Leesburg Business Park, 287 Virginia 187, 2014 case, demonstrates the error of the commission in this case. Mr. Jeffries was paralyzed from the neck down, it's almost 5 years ago now, doing construction work. There's no dispute about that. The commission held that the church and the Restoration Society were not in the construction business, therefore denied benefits. This is error, as shown by the Rodriguez case. The proper inquiry, as the Supreme Court has said, is whether the construction work Jeffries was engaged in when he was paralyzed from the neck down was part of the trade, business, or occupation of the church and the Restoration Society. You don't ask. The Supreme Court said that just because Mr. Jeffries was doing construction work, you don't ask whether or not the employer was in the construction business. You ask whether the construction work that he was doing was part of the trade, business, or occupation of the putative employer. In this case, the Restoration Society, their foundational documents clearly stated that the occupation of that society, that it was formed, quote, to purchase, restore, preserve, and maintain the Harvey School as a historical site, close quote. The construction work that Mr. Jeffries was doing was clearly a part of that foundational document of these organizations. So there should be, he should be in the trade, occupation, or business of the employer. He was. And that was what the error is by the full commission, just to put my finger right on. I want to call to the court's attention a case that I did not cite in my briefs. It's Spurlock versus Oakwood Hebrew Cemetery Association. It's a decision by the full commission, claim number 145-89-44. And in that case, the full commission held that was also, the Hebrew Cemetery Association was also a nonprofit organization, and that they were in the trade or business of running a cemetery, even though they had no direct employees hired to open, close, or mark off the burial plots. Mr. Spurlock was awarded benefits against the Uninsured Employers Fund and the Hebrew Cemetery Association as a statutory employee. I don't think there's any meaningful distinction between the Hebrew Cemetery case and the Mount Lebanon Missionary Baptist Church case. Clearly, the church was in the declared occupation of the Restoration Society, quote, to purchase, restore, preserve, and maintain the Harvey School as a historical site. None of the workers engaged in that business or occupation were direct employees of the church, but they are statutory employees as a matter of law. And I don't think there's any difference between those two cases. The fund tried to argue in its briefs that Mr. Jeffries was an independent contractor. We showed in that brief where that was completely opposite to what the commission actually held, and it was completely opposite to what they argued for the full commission as well. It's 20 minutes per side. Did I get that?
Yes, sir, you did.
All right, so, I mean, I just wanted to get right to the point and lay my finger on what I believe is to be the error. And I think that the Rodriguez case shows that. I would be glad to answer any questions that the court has on this issue. It is complex. If you're not, statutory employer doctrine gives a lot of people, question marks. But when you look at the Rodriguez case, it says exactly what the analysis is supposed to be, which is not the analysis that the full commission did. They made the same error in this case that was made in Rodriguez that was corrected by the Supreme Court. That's what we're asking this court to do.
Your contention is then that he's a statutory employee.
Absolutely.
As opposed to a direct employee.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Thank you. That was what I understood.
Yes, sir. So I still have 14 minutes left. I'll just save that unless the court has questions.
No, sir, I don't have any questions at this juncture, but thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Matthew Griffin. I'm here representing the Uninsured Employers Fund in defense of the workers' compensation case of Mr. Jeffries. With the court's permission, I respectfully request to reserve 5 minutes for potential rebuttal as well. Will that be allowed?
I will allow it because we're in a very unusual situation. Since you have a cross claim, I will allow it, particularly since Mr. Feynman has been very succinct with his argument. I think that we'll probably conclude the entire argument in less than 20 minutes rather than 40.
I will do my best to help the court.
You set a high standard, counsel. So.
thank you, Your Honors. While this is a case really about workers' compensation claims, which was brought against individuals and entities which are not the claimant's employer. Those are facts that have been decided already. The claimant was not the employee of Ms. Mosby, Ms. Annie Mosby, one of the named defendants. She was not the employee of the Mount Lebanon Missionary Baptist Church or the Historical Society, as I'll refer to it, the Historical Society of the Mount Lebanon Missionary Baptist Church. Those individuals and entities didn't control Mr. Jeffries' occupational tasks. They didn't control the means and methods in which he worked.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you so early in your argument, and I don't want to throw you off, but it seems that Mr. Feynman's really focusing on the statutory employee part of it as opposed to the common law. Do you want to address the arguments that he's laid out specifically as it relates to Rodriguez?
Yes, I will go directly to the statutory employer issue. This isn't a case about a claim against a statutory employer. That was, to the extent that that was asserted, that was abandoned long ago.
Let me stop you there, if I might, and I hate to interrupt you
okay.
again. Because I think one of the things you're indicating about the abandonment is in reference to the 5A18, the fact that he didn't preserve it and bring it up before the commission. But it was brought up and addressed by the commission. In fact, the fund brought it up.
The fund?
But it's something that was brought up and the commission did consider it. So what is it weird to do with that in reference to the abandonment?
Well, I think the fund, the court is familiar with the rules of the commission, and that the commission can take up issues sua sponte on various requests for review. The fund maintained its various challenges to the claim and felt it was compelled to do so because the commission could at any point take things up. But with respect to the claimant, the allegation that these individuals and entities were the statutory employer, we believe were abandoned at that initial stage, although we, on behalf of the fund, continued to maintain our various challenges in the event that the commission took that up. So, with respect to waiver, we believe that the claimant's assertion that this particular relief was a viable option was waived and abandoned when, after the deputy commissioner's opinion, which said this is not a case of a statutory employer situation, the claimant said, we agree, and asked that the commission summarily affirm that finding. Now, I understand that we have continued on behalf of the fund to raise our various challenges in the event that this issue is raised by the full commission. But moving beyond the issue of waiver, the case still does not fall into, as the commission says, a quote, statutory employer situation. First, I think in that analysis, you have to identify who the owner is. Right? So under 65.2-302, you have to identify both the owner and the subcontractor. In this case, who would be the owner? The evidence fails to establish, in our opinion, that the Historical Society or the church engaged Mr. Johnson or Mr. Jeffries to perform any work. The owner under the statute must engage the subcontractor in some fashion. That, we believe, is essentially what triggers, essentially a triggering component of the statutory employer doctrine. In addition, in this case, the evidence we shows that Miss Annie Mosby, engaged Mr. Lorenzo Wilson. If you're familiar with the case, Mr. Lorenzo Wilson was the initial contractor to perform the work. She did so personally, and she later engaged Mr. William Jerome Johnson personally. They were to carry out those activities for her. She arranged this. Miss Mosby, the society was accepted as an auxiliary of the church. And as Mr. Feynman points out, they have some aspirational goals with respect to the schoolhouse. But the actual activity that were performed in this case were arranged by Miss Mosby personally. The schoolhouse wasn't placed on the church property. It was placed on her family property. And despite all these facts, the claimants contends that yet the Historical Society and the church are actually the owner of this project, this construction project. Moving forward, with respect to the subcontractor, there's really, again, no connection between the Historical Society or the church and Mr. Jeffries or Mr. Johnson. We're talking, one of the difficult parts about this case is Mr. Johnson's an important component of the case, but he wasn't named as a defendant. He wasn't identified, and no claim was brought against him. Mr. Johnson was the individual who contracted or agreed and hired Mr. Jeffries. He's the one who controlled everything on the job site. He controlled the means and method and directed the occupational tasks of Mr. Jeffries. And then, again, once we've established who the owner is, we need to determine, I believe, whether the activities that Mr. Jeffries were engaged in fall within the trade business occupation of the owner. And in this case, clearly, Ms. Mosby, she's not in the trade, business, or occupation of building construction or constructing any structures whatsoever. She resides in California. She's employed as a mental health aide. She mentors children. She testified that she's never been involved in any construction or real estate development in any way. Okay. And with respect to the church and the historical society, their trade, business, or occupation is not tied to one document. I think as Mr. Feynman has pointed out, the court here in Virginia, the Supreme Court, has identified the Shell case in looking at private entities, and in those instances, you look at the activity, whether the activity is in the entity's business that is normally conducted by the entity's employees as opposed to independent contractors.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt you again, but in reference to what Mr. Feynman's indicating about the Rodriguez case, and I'm just getting you to comment on that.
Yes.
Rodriguez essentially looks at the foundational documents as a means of determining what the purpose of the business was, and I think that's one of the elements that he's bringing up.
Yes, I do think that's important, but in the case of Rodriguez, what we're looking at is whether, I think in that case, whether this was solely for the purpose of development. And I think you compare that with some of the other cases cited, and where they're looking at whether the business was solely for this real estate function or whether it had a broader purpose. And then I believe in the Rodriguez case, what they're looking at is whether the construction of a structure is not essential or necessary in the business, but is that what they use? Again, they're applying, I believe, the Shell test, and whether they use their normal employees to engage that. And I think that is not the case here. The church obviously has spiritual goals. They employ individuals to carry out and advance the spiritual efforts of the church and advance its congregation. But when it comes to constructing structures, that is not what they do. That is not what they use their employees for in their normal business. Now, there is the mission statement and the foundational documents that Mr. Feynman cites too, but I believe they're aspirational in nature. They describe the outcome that they hope that the society wishes to achieve, right? But they don't actually describe and articulate that this is where we're going to accomplish this through our employees. And I think that is the inquiry that the court needs to look at. And again, not to belabor this, but there are a couple of cross fields. I would like to circle back off the statutory employer just for a moment, because the fund does have its own independent appeal in this case. And one of the things I think it's important to look at in this case is the Virginia Workers' Compensation Commission has already addressed each of these. I believe the standard of review is being reviewed de novo, is that the findings of facts are viewed in light most favorable to the prevailing party below, which would be the fund. And that if the findings are supported by credible evidence, they stay. And in this case, the commission, we believe, correctly found the claimant was not an employee of any of the named defendants. Again, correctly found that this is not a situation of a statutory employer. We don't have an owner engaged in a trade business occupation of constructing structures or schoolhouses. We have an aspirational goal. We don't have them actually engaging employees in that endeavor, nor do we have the other necessary components, I believe, for 302, which is the connection and the contract between the owner and subcontractor. We have Ms. Mosby engaging personally in these activities to put the schoolhouse on her property, but we don't have the church or historical society acting or engaging these individuals for this purpose. And I don't believe the credible evidence in the record would support that either.
Well, didn't she, I believe her husband purchased the property for, or purchased the building for her, and then didn't she then declare that it was to be owned by the Historical Society or the, I realize they placed it on property that was owned by her family, some type of heirship property.
Right, I think, if you look back, I think in 2003, and I think it actually begins 2001, not 2003, there is this goal of, you know, initiating and creating this historical society to protect this important structure. This is something that was important to her, it was important to the community. And I think Miss, you know, it's unfortunate, but the reality is what they hope to do, the excitement of the community itself, the involvement of the community, the ability to make progress really wasn't taking place.
So,
and Miss,
so basically, Council, to excuse me for interrupting you, you're saying that there never was a meeting or any type of general understanding among the Historical Society, and I realize they dwindled down to practically, you know, maybe three or four people, if that many. There never was an understanding by them that they would own, once the church was purchased, that it would be considered to be the property of the Historical Society.
I don't believe there's any evidence in the record. Based on my recollection, it is a large record, but I don't believe there's any evidence in the record to establish that that was their understanding or of the.
Thank you. I don't want to get you off track, but okay. I wanted to be sure.
I think I have 1 minute before I should.
Well, and, you can go into your own time.
But again, I think that the Workers' Compensation Commission assessed all the evidence, weighed it improperly, and reached proper findings. Unfortunately, in this case, we believe the commission's conclusion sentence in its opinion unfortunately fails, is inconsistent with the findings that it had in the pages preceding and in the appeals that preceded this this most recent April 6, 2017 opinion. We believe that 65.2-704 requires the commission to make an award or opinion that actually carries out its decision and findings. And in this case, the commission, we believe, found that none of the named defendants are the claimant's employers, and that this wasn't a situation of a statutory employer. This was not a statutory employer situation. Yet, for some reason, the final conclusion sentence in the opinion simply states that the finding with respect to the Historical Society is reversed. It didn't address the award against the church. And I think this is a long and kind of, there are a lot of parties and a lot of people involved in this case. And the deputy commissioner's opinion at the outset probably added to a little bit of the confusion, because in that opinion, the deputy commissioner says that both Ms. Mosby is the employer, the church is the employer, and the Historical Society is the employer, and also rules that it's not a statutory employer situation. But then in that conclusion, in that opinion, followed up with an award only against the church. And you know, when you compare that with the most recent remand opinion and the conclusion of the remand opinion, we think that the remand opinion's conclusion simply is not consistent with the findings of the commission and on appeal. And therefore, we ask that the remand opinion, the findings in the remand opinion be affirmed, but that it be amended to reflect that the June, the award contained in the June 17, 2015 opinion is reversed, and that the claimant's claim has now been denied and dismissed.
Counsel, based upon your argument, should you prevail, would that be, you ask us to make that finding, basically, should you prevail, that would have to be remanded to the commission to make that, would that not, for that reversal?
I think, I believe this court could reach that finding itself and articulate the conclusion, the final, well, what may be the final conclusion or may not be the final conclusion of the case. But alternatively, if the court is not inclined to do so, a remand with instructions to I suppose directing the commission as to what to write in the final opinion would be appropriate. But again, in this case, I don't believe that final conclusion, and I've never had a situation where I've appealed one sentence in a conclusion, but it simply isn't consistent with the findings of fact articulated. This isn't a case about, none of these individuals are employers. We've been here before. We've had oral arguments in Lexington. We've had a significant briefing on this issue. And throughout the period, the argument was these entities, these individuals were the employer. Not once, I don't believe it was advanced that they were the statutory employer. We believe even though the fund itself felt compelled to maintain its challenge, that does not negate the waiver, in our opinion, an abandonment of the claimant's assertion. It doesn't advance the claimant's assertion that this is, in fact, a statutory employer. We contend that is now, only now, being advanced on this appeal. It wasn't advanced on the request for review, at least on behalf of the fund, we believe it wasn't advanced at that point. It wasn't advanced in the prior appeals in this case.
Council, before we sit down, do you have any statement you want to make in reference to any difference that it would make whether we have a business for profit or we have a non-profit organization?
Yes. Your Honor, that was raised in the briefs, and I do think, I don't think it's, whether it's a non-profit or a for-profit business changes the analysis. I think the Supreme Court's got it right, that when it's a public entity or government entity or public utility, that requires a different analysis and view. But when it comes to a private entity, whether it's for profit or not, I think the Shell analysis, that is looking at whether the activity that the claimant was engaged in is in the entity's business, that is normally carried out by its employees, that's the correct analysis. And I think if you apply that analysis here in this case, setting aside the issues of waiver or the fact that none of these individuals ever, there is no contract between the owner and the subcontractor, if you apply that test, you still end up with the same result, we believe, that this is not a case of a statutory employee. They aren't in the trade business occupation of constructing the schoolhouse or engaging in construction that Mr. Jeffries was. Did not use employees, and I don't believe there's any evidence in the record of any other employees engaged in this activity. I did want to comment, if I'm allowed, on the Spurlock case. I'm not familiar with the details of it, but it would seem to me in that case, I think my time's up.
Well, counsel, obviously we're not going to have any rebuttal time, so
thank you.
If you want to make just a brief statement, given that the Spurlock case was mentioned today, if you want to make something that's less than a minute, I'll be happy to hear it, or we'll be happy to hear it.
No, Your Honor, I'm not intimately familiar with the details of the Spurlock case, so I think it might be, unnecessary for me to attempt to explain it without, full articulation of the facts.
Thank you. I'm not familiar with it either, so I thought maybe you could help us out, but I'm sure Mr. Feynman can do that. Thank you.
May it please the court. The fund's contention that this was aspirational to purchase and move and rebuild this school, I think is a fiction. Mr. Jeffrey's neck is broken. It's not aspirational. They were doing what they said they were going to do. This whole enterprise was put into motion by the Restoration Society, which asked to be part of the church. The church, by congregational vote, accepted them to be an auxiliary of the church. It was always known that the work of the Restoration Society was going to be done through contractors. And we cited that in the briefs, that where that's what they told the church right from the beginning, that's what they were doing. Everybody knew that. The pastor of the church and the associate pastor of the church were both on the board of the Restoration Society. They were going together as they had agreed to do, and this was the manner that they had agreed to do it, through contractors. There can be no question that the purpose, the raison d'etre, I'm sorry I don't speak French, but the reason for being of the Restoration Society was that they were going to purchase, restore, and maintain the Harvey School, which is what they were doing when Mr. Jeffries broke his neck. And they all said from the beginning, before Mr. Jeffries broke his neck, or had his neck broken for him, that they were going to do it through contractors. The statutory employer doctrine says that that is a situation where our workers' comp laws protects all the workers who are engaged in the enterprise by the owner. The documents show that the school was purchased in the name of the Restoration Society by its president, Mrs. Mosby. Those documents are crystal clear. That's what the documents at the time said, and that's the way it is. So to say that this was just aspirational, what we believe is a fiction. It was what they did. It's what they said they were going to do. It's what they were doing, and it is what happened. There's no aspiration here. This is reality. I want to go to my notes. They're still asking the wrong question, according to the Rodriguez case. They're still representing to this court that the church and the Restoration Society were not in the construction business. That is the error that Rodriguez court said you cannot do. You cannot ask whether they were in the construction business. You have to ask whether or not the construction business that he was doing was part of the trade occupational business of the church and the Restoration Society. Now here, and we said that we don't know of any case where it has the standard for determining what is the trade business or occupation of a nonprofit organization has been determined. But all the cases say there is no one test. The Supreme Court has said several times, the Shell test is a possible test. It can work, and it can work nicely in private, you know, private businesses for profit. They have recognized that the Shell test is not applicable to governmental or utility organizations because it just doesn't work. And the same thing is true for a nonprofit organization. It's not a private enterprise, for-profit activity, so that Shell test really doesn't work. You know, what you have to do is look at the foundational documents. What was this nonprofit organization reason for being? I would submit that that is the occupation of the nonprofit organization. And it's clear what their reason for being was, which was a very beneficent purpose. And that everybody here meant good. They knew, and this is in the record, they knew they were supposed to have insurance. The pastor testified, we thought we did, but we didn't. And Miss Mosby, as president of the Restoration Society, told Mr. Johnson, I don't have insurance. I'm supposed to. She knew that they didn't, and that's why I think there has been so much litigation around this case that the fund is obviously looking at a horrendous claim and doing everything they can not to have to pay it. But the facts are that he was an employee. They even argued that at the commission below. Of Mr. Johnson. Mr. Johnson was hired by the Restoration Society officers to do the work of the Restoration Society. The Restoration Society is part of the church by congregational vote. And that's where we are. And he's entitled to his benefits under the law and so badly needs them. Let me look at my notes. I think the issue of a statutory employer is a question of law that I think this court can review de novo and should review de novo. The goal never changed. She kept the financial documents, the financial records of the Restoration Society all the way through the date of the hearing, the first hearing in this case. We don't know what's happened since then because everything gets no discovery after that. But she was maintaining the Restoration Society as an entity, as an organization all the way through. Looking at my notes to see what other points. The question of waiver, we think, is really kind of ironic given the history of this case and how we were here once
the commission found that the fund had waived all of its defenses. They came here, this court said, no, there was no waiver. But 8.01-384A says that arguments made at trial via written pleadings and memorandum are deemed preserved for assertion on appeal unless expressly withdrawn or waived. They have not laid their finger on the record to show where there was an express withdrawal or waiver of that position, because there is no such place in the record that they can lay their finger on. They argue that they don't, they just bare argument. They don't lay their finger on the record to show where we expressly withdrew that. We don't believe there's any waiver at all. When we went back on remand, the fund argued the statutory employer issue for two full pages of the transcript. They never argued before the full commission that there was a waiver. Jeffries, by his counsel, myself, we argued the trade business or occupation of the church and the Restoration Society was what Mr. Jeffries was engaged in. That's all found in the supplemental appendix. Where they argued the issue below is in the supplemental appendix pages 7 through 10 and 12 through 19. And then where I argued it was 21 through 22. The point is that this whole enterprise was put forward by the Restoration Society and by the church. The Spurlock versus the Oakwood Hebrew Cemetery Association was a similar case where the cemetery operation was put forth by the Hebrew Cemetery Association, a nonprofit religious organization. They obviously had, this is another thing I want to address. It's obvious that one of the occupations of the church is to fulfill the spiritual needs of its members. I know one could dispute that. But as we pointed out, you can have more than one occupation. We cited the Indiana case that says that, the statute doesn't say that they have to be engaged in the trade or business, but part of the trade or business. It has to be part of the trade, occupation, or business of the employer. And so, this was definitely part of something that they were doing. It was an enterprise that they undertook knowingly, consciously, by congregational vote. And it was an enterprise that their pastor and their associate pastor, was very active in as board members of the Restoration Society. I think if it's good enough, if the doctrine can be applied to the Hebrew Cemetery Association, it ought to be applied the same way in this case. The Hebrew Cemetery Association did not have direct employees doing the work of the Cemetery Association. That they had statutory employees, and one of whom was Mr. Spurlock. Look at my notes. For them to argue that there was no connection between Mr. Jeffries and the Church and the Restoration Society is just not supported by the record. It's clear that the Restoration Society was doing all of this work through its president, just as they said they would do when they asked to be part of the church. That was, if you look at when they requested to be part of the church, they said, we're asking to become part of the church. The members of the Restoration Society will do all of the work and raise all of the money. And that was the agreement at the beginning, and that's what they did. So to say that there's no connection between the two is to ignore the very foundational genesis of how this whole enterprise got started. It got started because the Restoration Society was formed. It asked to become part of the church. They met with the church. The church had a congregational vote and accepted them. And then they from that point on, went about the business, the occupation that they said they were going to do. And unfortunately for everybody involved, particularly Mr. Jeffries, who's badly injured in the enterprise. So I think I've covered the points that I wanted to make, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that the court has on any issues.
Questions. Mr. Fineman, we don't have any questions at this time.
Okay.
We will, in as much as counsel, you used up, of course, all of your time, so we're going to come down and greet counsel, as is our custom, after a merit case. And